I just want to begin by saying thank you very much to Gail and Rich for inviting me to speak to you today. And what I'm going to do today is actually going to build on some of the theory that Antonella started exploring this morning as I start to talk about post-human machine animals. I'm hoping this kind of continues the conversation. So in my own work on post-human care, I've been looking at a range of machine and non-human companion species participating in care. So while a range of machine animals designed for care is, there is a range that's currently available, and including some of you know, this is Pero and Miro, I believe. Miro was in presentation yesterday, coming out of Sheffield Robotics, and Pero is a very much older companion robot that has had great success that's developed in Japan. So I've been thinking, despite the fact that these are currently available, there's actually a surprising paucity of such entities in the cultural fiction and the speculative representations that depict robotic care. And I'm thinking here of films like Robot and Frank, the television programs like Acta Magniscor and its English counterpart Humans, novels like Louisa Hall's Speak, and comic series like Descender. And so in these, but robot animals are actually relatively rare in robot fictions, the Philip K. Dick novel notwithstanding. and when they do appear, they're more likely to be assassins than caregivers, as in, for example, We Three, I think we're going to hear about this this afternoon, in Fahrenheit 451, or these kind of charming but peripheral moving furniture type characters like K-9 in Doctor Who or Bandit in Descender, that's Bandit there. Though animals are often vital models for robot designers seeking to create comforting mechanical companions, the robot Seal Pero jumps to mind in that case. Film and literature are preoccupied with humanoid machines, with Terminators, Hubots, replicants, simulants, and synths that, mechanical innards notwithstanding, satisfy readers and viewers' anthropocentric preference for humanoid protagonists, even as their machine status lends those characters an uncanny non-human myth. So it's telling, in fact, that the few appearances of Pero, an actual, as I mentioned, actual robotic seal designed for care, on television are designed for laughs. So Pero has made guest appearances on The Simpsons and the Netflix comedy Master of None. So in the Master of None episode, Old People, when Aziz Ansari's sidekick Arnold, played by Eric Wareheim, inherits his grandfather's Pero, he quickly becomes attached to the robot. He's concerned about missing its calls for attention. Excuse me. He longs to take Pero with him to a restaurant, but embarrassed by his attachment, he settles for tucking Pero in a blanket and popping a little pacifier-shaped charging cord into the robot's mouth and patting it regretfully before exiting. So while attachment to humanoid robots tends to produce drama and suspense and even horror, think, for example, of Caleb's mortal affection for Ava in Ex Machina, the attachment to robot animals is more likely to be played for laughs. In fictional representation, we tend to find explorations of human attachments, often depicted as over-attachment, to machines or animals, but very rarely machine animals, as if the boundary crossing between human and machine or human and animal is all we can bear. So Master of None satirizes Arnold's naive attachment, there he is again, to Pero, an attachment that leads him to adopt the robot after his grandfather's death, and moreover to treat it like mechanical kin, requiring attention and care. There is no question for Arnold that Pero cannot simply be disposed of like the bulk of his grandfather's belongings, which includes comically out-of-date technologies, most prominently a malfunctioning VCR that sets off the comedy early in the show. And the possibility of Pero's disposal is never discussed. Since Pero is kin, it must be adopted, not discarded. Arnold's commitment to machine-animal brutality is played for laughs, but such commitment is not, in fact, uncommon. When Sony discontinued its robot dog, Ivo, in 2006, and then withdrew restructuring support, In 2013, many owners were bereft, unable to repair their ailing machine pets, but unwilling to relegate them to the trash. Owners began holding funeral services for their broken companions at Kuju Temple before the machines were dismantled or discarded. So Pero, Aibo, and other machine animals are what Donna Haraway calls boundary projects. And as she explains, objects are boundary projects, but boundaries shift from within. Boundaries are very tricky. What boundaries provisionally contain remains generative, productive of meaning and meanings and bodies. Citing or citing boundaries is a risky practice. So tricky indeed. These objects refuse to sit comfortably within the territory of non-living or inert matter, demanding instead the consideration and privileges typically afforded humans and pets. Adoption, mourning, funeral rites, in short, care. So today's presentation is part of a larger project investigating the concept and representation of what I'm calling post-human care. And as the phrase implies, this work explores relations of care between humans and non-humans within a post-humanist new materialist framework that interrogates the structures buttressing anthropocentric speciesist interpretations and evaluations of care. And so today's presentation explores the other side of post-human care, so to speak. That is, the uncared for, the more than human matter, effective things, machine animals and animal machines that are treated as disposable, as unworthy of care, a status I explore in relation to cultural theories of originality and individuality. Excuse me. Just getting a cold, over a cold, but hold my voice with it. So elsewhere I've written about the concern, even anxiety, triggered by robot animals that exceed the narrow parameters of attention and concern typically for objects. Today I want to extrapolate further on the repercussions of this excess in practices and representations of the disposal of these boundary objects and boundary creatures, those liminal bodies that have been central to post-humanist critique since Haraway's initial analysis of, as you see, odd boundary creatures, simians, cyborgs, and women, all of which have had a stabilizing place in the great Western evolutionary, technological, and biological narratives, end quote. Today I want to consider what we do when machine, animal, animal-machine boundary creatures cease to function. Are machine animals inevitably disposable bodies in the end? As the Aibo example makes clear, many balk at the prospect of treating machine animals as waste once their prescribed functionality ceases. So what do we do with non-functioning boundary objects and creatures? Can we just get rid of them? Can and do we simply throw them away, and why or not? So the remainder of my talk will attempt to respond to such questions by considering a range of literal and metaphorical machine animals, troubling boundary creatures, both organic and technological, treated as if they were machines, that is, affectless and insensate, utilitarian, by the humans that own and or use them. And I examine what happens to these creatures when their function expires or is exhausted. So what happens to this useless matter, or is this matter, in fact, useless? Excuse me. So I'd like to set the stage with a few narratives and images of machine, human, animal disposability. So in February 2018, this sensational animal abuse story hit the headlines. On November 21st, Belen Albicosia flushed her emotional support animal, dwarf hamster Pebbles, down the toilet after the animal was denied passage on Spirit Airlines flight to South Florida. Stripped of its emotional support function by the airline, the hamster became simply waste requiring disposal. Of course, this is not a machine animal, but it was clearly treated as if it were and as if it were broken. In the 2012 Swedish television program I mentioned earlier, Akta Mäskor, one of the protagonists really dreads the idea of his beloved robot being recycled, and this is the kind of image we see in the program. This image of humanoid robots, Hubots as they're called, traveling along a conveyor belt toward the mouth of a recycling machine, replays on the horror of these humanoid bodies, these living machines treated as trash. And similarly, in Louisa Hall's 2015 novel Speak, which explores the repercussions of an overly successful robot companion, the Baby Bot, designed for children, the novel opens and closes with robot narration, and the robot narrator, Eva, describes the warehouse in the desert where she and her fellow confiscated Baby Bots, quote, Baby Bots banned and marked for disposal, have been piled and abandoned. Eva reflects on the liminal status as a disposable, on her liminal status as a disposable body, a machine, a feeling machine, mourning the loss of care by her child caregiver. And one more example. In Grant Morrison's Frank Quitely's comic, We Three, I think we'll hear about that some more this afternoon, three companion animals, a dog, a cat, and a rabbit, bioengineered into deadly machine animal weapons, become a liability once their functionality falters. Scheduled for extermination, the animals escape the confines of the lab with the help of one of their creators. Carnage results as human security forces attempt to eliminate the machine animal weapons that refuse to be trashed, exerting their animal agency even as their mechanized, their mechanical weaponization enacts violence beyond their control. So these examples, and I'm sure you can recall many others from your own reading and viewing, Coetzee's novel, Disgrace comes to mind, Andrew Cotting's recent film, Like and the Dogs, or even Terminator, The Final Image of Terminator, for example, kind of speak to a public imaginary that depends on distinctions between valuable and disposable bodies, and is fascinated and often unsettled by boundary creatures, matter that appears misplaced or uncategorizable. And despite their very different media and genres, these examples secure their impact on viewers, I would argue, and readers, by positioning liminal figures, mechanized animals like Pebbles and We Three, or affected machines like Q-Bots and Babybots, in scenarios reserved for junk and refuse, toilets, trash compactors, remote storage facilities, and garbage heaps. In her elaboration of the destructive history of the Eurocentric humanist paradigm, Rosie Bradotti describes how, quote, the binary logic of identity and otherness as respectively the motor for and the cultural logic of universal humanism, and how that has produced humanist citizens on the one hand and disposable bodies on the other. In Giorgio Agamben's term, these bodies represent bare life, stripped of all political, social, and economic significance. Disposable bodies, bare life, these terms provide helpful shorthand for discussing minoritized modes of existence, the ontopolitical liminality of valueless, reified bodies, a category that often includes a variety of literal and metaphorical machine animals and animal machines. Bradotti's characterization is useful for identifying the gaps and fissures within what she describes as the cultural logic of universal humanism. If the binary logic of humanism was unassailable, stories of flushed pets, trashed and warehouse robots, in short, the disposal of ostensibly disposable bodies would have very little impact on the readers and viewers. To state the obvious, Pebble's demise would not be newsworthy if there was, in fact, consensus around his disposability. So in other words, boundary creature narratives expose the inadequacy of humanism to account for the incredible range and significance of machine, animal, human matter. And in this way, studying boundary creatures can initiate post-humanist critique in paying attention to the failed logic of universal humanism that would see so-called real humans on one side and non-human matter, whether machine, animal, or otherwise, on the other. So these images of a flushed hamster, of Q-Bots being fed into a recycling machine, of Baby Bots piled into trucks on their way to storage facility, dumping grounds, mechanized animals pursued for extermination. These images of discarded, non-functional, non-human bodies are designed to alarm, right? Ringing warning bells that highlight the ethical risk involved in the transformation into trash of life and an invasive and highly contested category. And I use it here in its most capacious sense. whether that life is artificial, organic, silicon, carbon, human, or more than. So to further explore the ethics involved in the disposability of boundary creatures, I want to examine another representation of liminal lives engineered for human use. Many of you may be familiar with Margaret Atwood's novel Oryx and Crake, part of her Mad Adam trilogy. Maybe you know it. It invokes the idea of the machine animal through the lens of biotechnology, which attempts to transform vital, entangled existence into marketable, utilitarian matter. So by its very definition, biotechnology is the instrumentalization of life. According to the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, biotechnology is, in fact, any technological application that uses biological systems, living organisms, or derivatives thereof to make or modify products or processes for specific use. So biotech transforms organic matter into a kind of machine organism, one with a particular utility and function. Or more precisely, biotechnology treats organic matter as technology, since according to Eugene Thacker, biotechnology is premised on the conceit that in fact biology is itself a technology, one that is, as he puts it, in fact, a better technology than any we can build. So in this sense, the technological side of biotechnological describes a shift in perception rather than any shift in entities themselves. It shifts the emphasis to functionality rather than any kind of being for itselfness. As such, biotechnology produces machine animals before any material interventions are made. In the first Mad novel, Oryx and Crake, the reader is introduced to a biotech project that bioengineers pigs to perform as living incubators to house multiple human organs in preparation for xenotransplantation. So these organ-growing entities are nicknamed pagoons, which is a portmanteau of pig and balloon, since these creatures appear inflated to make room for extra organs. For the novel's protagonist, Jimmy, pagoons are troubling creatures, to say the least. He recalls a childhood encounter with the biotechnological entities, which are, he notes, quote, bigger and fatter than ordinary pigs, so leave room for all the extra organs. And Jimmy's father works at Organ and Farms and is an architect on this pagoon project and takes Jimmy to see the enormous creatures in their special buildings, heavily secured. And he explains that, quote, the kidnapping of a pagoon and its finely honed genetic material by a rival outfit would have been a disaster. So their contents and consequently their beings are valuable commodities that, just like any other corporate commodity, must be protected from theft and sabotage, at least as long as they carry their precious cargo. Once they've donated all their organs, their exhausted bodies, these living machines, are useless and therefore disposable, and no one is actually quite sure where pagoons go post-donation, but the rumor is that they end up on the plates in the organic cafeteria prospect. Jimmy finds particularly alarming, balking at the idea of eating, quote, an animal whose cells might be identical with at least some of his own. So when Jimmy meets the live pagoons, he finds them, quote, slightly frightening with their runny noses and tiny white-lashed pink eyes. They glance up at him as if they saw him. Really saw him and might have plans for him later. The unsettling convergence of technology of this finely honed genetic material and the living, breathing animal who fixes Jimmy in its enigmatic stare, this clings to Jimmy, who finds himself haunted by memories of the pagoon long after his encounter. Jimmy is lonely in the corporate compound where his family lives, and he longs for a friend, but his father warns him not to fall in love with the pagoons because, quote, they'll eat you up in a minute. Jimmy insists, oh, they won't because he's their friend, but at the same time, he longs to poke them with a stick and make them run around. So the gaze of these biotechnological creatures is powerfully uncanny. They see Jimmy, really see him, while his parents tend to treat him as invisible. In addition, the pagoons contain parts of him, right? Human parts. Yet they are utilitarian biotechnology. They are constructed for a purpose, one that, and once that purpose is fulfilled, filter discarded. So cocoons in the lab are a kind of transparent container housing valuable organs, which makes them both incredibly valuable and entirely expendable. They are designed to be discarded once they have served their instrumental purpose. In other words, they are trash. As Julian Stalabros explains, the commodity and trash, quote, are as closely linked as production and consumption. It may even be that we can think of commodities as deferred trash. So looking at cocoons rather than through them is transgressive, challenging their status as commodities, as deferred trash, since, quote, as Stalabros says, trash as such tends to be left unregarded, edited out of vision and generally of photographs, ignored except as a practical problem, and deplored from an aesthetic point of view, which repudiates it so as not to see it. The cocoon that makes eye contact, or later in the trilogy, runs free amid post-disaster wasteland, no longer functions as a living incubator, a commodified transparent object. Indeed, beyond the confines of the lab, the cocoon no longer functions as anything, but simply is, transformed from utilitarian biotechnological object or machine, animal, to vibrant creature. Both Jimmy and cocoons are vulnerable, dependent, affective bodies whose survival, contentment, and pleasure depend on the whims of unreliable adults. In other words, there is a moment of reluctant recognition in the scene of the Jimmy cocoon gaze, a trespassing of the artificial lines demarcating humans from animals, from technology. The encounter highlights the dogged importance of individual contact for ethical significance. Jimmy's encounter with these particular cocoons produces a moment of ethical engagement that undermines their disposability. Jimmy's encounter with the faces of the biotechnological machine animal haunts him, suggesting as it does that those particular boundary creatures were more than biotechnological objects. In this sense, Jimmy's unsettling communion with individual cocoons relies on the cult of the individual, treating identification and empathy with particular embodied subjects as the route to an ethic that undermines and in fact prohibits disposability, in this case of the biotechnological animal as consumer matter, a deferral further deferred. The dread of the transgressive human cocoon gaze is captured especially in this is Jason Courtney's illustration, which emphasizes the power of the face-to-face encounter in its rendering of the other cocoons here in the background is just kind of landscape, right? Landscape material is fleshly, indistinguishable humps. Indeed, Courtney's illustration emphasizes the singularity of the face, despite the third person plural in Atwood's text. It's they glanced up at him as if they saw him, really saw him. So Jimmy's revelatory face-to-face with these cocoons, or a cocoon in Courtney's painting, evokes Levinas's ethical philosophy, which describes the face of the other as an arresting imperative, one that commands of the perceiver, thou shalt not kill. And indeed, Jimmy's encounter strengthens the taboo of consuming the cocoon. But what of those critters, distant or herded, whose faces we cannot see, who remain indistinguishable masses? What are the cocoons as landscape, the fleshly indistinguishable humps in Courtney's illustration? What of the machine faces of Perro and Ivo? Do these faces count? do they count? Moreover, what of those boundary creatures without faces? So does facelessness, this indistinction, disqualify one from ethical consideration? As Erica Fudge has demonstrated, the role of the face in justifying and activating concern has a long history, and she cites Milton's poetic depiction of de-individualized drinkers in her article on the subject. These drinkers transformed into a faceless herd to discuss denigrated, even disposable non-human bodies. And as she writes, lack of reason means lack of a face means lack of individuality, lack of home, which in turn means that these beings are outside of full ethical consideration. And she goes to show how the face remains a marker of ethical status in contemporary thinking. So within this formulation, faces individualized, particular bodies as matters for concern, set apart from the faceless herd, those interchangeable, even disposable faceless objects. And following Fudge's logic, which returns us to Levinas, facelessness is tied to disposability, to killability. And what particularly interests me in this formulation is the privileging of the individualization and distinction which connects the modern fetish with the original, what Benjamin identifies as the aura, and reveals interesting parallels in Levinas's idea of the human face as, quote, signification without context, as an encounter with, as he described, infinity, imminence, with an inarticulate yet overwhelming something that demands the subject's response as an encounter with a kind of ethical aura, if you will. By this logic, then, huddled lagoons who do not make eye contact, these machine animals, remain outside of ethical consideration. These undifferentiated, biotechnological creatures do not make any claims on us, the original privileged, individuated humanist subject. And it's not until he encounters the lagoon face that Jimmy feels truly implicated. Much like the original work of art in Benjamin, the face in Levinas emits an aura, a something that calls out to the beholder, alerting him or her to the aura's irreducible value. And for Benjamin, this is economic and cultural, and for Levinas, ethical and divine. And this perpetuation of these anthropocentric humanist distinctions between cherished, sacred, individual beings and profane, undifferentiated, disposable machine animal bodies can translate, possibly, it actually translates Benjamin's pivotal inquiry into, as Montale suggests, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, into bodies that matter in the age of robotics and technology. So, put very crudely, then, individuals with faces available to the human gaze, matter, while faceless matter remains disposable. And when the two become conflated, when individual creatures with faces, like Pebbles, Bree, Eva, even Peril, are treated as disposable, we tend to respond with confusion and even outrage. So I'd like to return to my opening question. So what and who are disposable bodies and why? Which is another way of asking what matter matters. Post-human boundary creatures like lagoons and Ivo and Pebbles and V3 and others challenge humanist hierarchies that would distinguish between individual human subjects on the one hand and disposable others on the other. Liberal humanism relies on a belief in the myth of this intrinsic value of the human, while everything non-human has some version of use value. Anti-humanist and post-humanist critiques have exposed the value of the human as hardly universal, demonstrating that some people, some bodies, are in fact more human and therefore more valuable than others. And this is why the designation person has been so culturally, legally, and ethically important. It confers intrinsic value, non-disposability. Bradotti identifies non-human animals as prominent disposable bodies, traded in a global market of post-human exploitation. Of course, this disposability is nuanced and graduated. It may be immediate or gradual, absolute or contingent, depending on a whole host of factors, including species, sex, and market fluctuation. As Caldera Coulter explains, quote, some kinds of animals are deemed disposable very quickly simply because of their sex. Some farm animals are killed mere hours after their birth, in fact. Similarly, non-nutritional organic matter, plants, fungi, insects, gastropods, are most often disposable, raised to make way for economically productive matter, housing, retail spaces, motorways, etc. So that said, a face can go a long way to disrupt these boundaries since, as discussed, faces make a claim on their beholders. While Levinas would limit this effect to the human, others have been more generous in considering the ethical significance of feline, bovine, canine, or even equine companion. So what if we were to adopt a strategically pedantic reading of the face, going back to kind of definitions of the face as to do with relation, one that provides a capacious definition well suited to critical post-humanism's dismantling of humanist anthropocentrism. The fact that in these rhetorically loaded terms, the face, rather, need not be unique marker of individuality. It is merely an acknowledgement of matter as relational, as available for apprehension by someone or something, an expanded version of Levinas's vision of ethics as relational, his treatment of responsibility as concomitant with responsibility. And a lot of feminist philosophers have picked up on this, people like Kelly Oliver, this idea of responsibility being combined with responsibility. Hence, machine-animal or animal-machine faces, even when mechanically reproduced and identical to one another, are markers of their relationality. So if we combine the ethical significance of the face with a posthumanist conceptualization of the face as a marker of relationality, as opposed to individuality and immanence, might we further advance a critical posthumanism skeptical towards the cult of the individual, individualized rather human, one that dismantles the humanist scaffolding that vertically organizes bodies according to ideal of humanity and individuality. Biotechnology mobilizes this skepticism in its perforation and erasure of humanist boundaries, making subjects and objects increasingly difficult to distinguish at once bio and tech, animal and machine, natural and unnatural. But at the same time, of course, biotechnology is an industry that regards organisms as commodified, marketable tools. It rarely does the opposite. In other words, draw attention to the vitality of things or treat tools as organisms, as vibrant matter. However, bias, I'm coming from literary and film studies, I would suggest this is where fiction and imagination intervene. In Atwood, machine-animal pagoons escape the lab and become unpredictable beings of their own. In Master of None, Arnold finds vitality in his grandfather's pharaoh, ostensibly a tool to mitigate his grandfather's loneliness. In Japan, Aibo owners that treat machines as kin and conduct funeral rites. As Joanne Latimer explains, it's a long position, humanism works divisions, right, between the body, nature, and the material, and consciousness, and the physical, between self and other, between inside and outside, human and animal. And these divisions underpin the figure of the individual as the essence of the enlightenment human, the sovereign subject. So I opened today's presentation with images of boundary creature disposal that alerted us to both the power and the volatility of humanist hierarchies. The Alba Clausia story, or I should probably say Pebbles story, for example, is particularly striking for its blunt illustration of the instrumentalization of non-human animal life. Once its function has expired, the emotional support animal, hamster, becomes disposable. But as I've tried to demonstrate, this example and others at once expose, these other ones as well, they expose and resist the humanist structures that Bredaud and Latimer describe. In laying bare the violence and volatility of humanist hierarchies, these narratives destabilize their structure. By looking closely at machine-animal, animal-machines, and biotechnological boundary creatures, so by paying attention to those bodies deemed unworthy of attention and care, to ostensibly disposable bodies, one can begin, I would argue, to imagine ethical value that moves beyond the cult of human individuality to consider at least the possibility of what Jane Bennett, following Latour, terms the horizontalizing of the ontological plane. So in other words, cultural narrative disposability can further posthumanist critiques of the cult of the individual human subject, challenging viewers and readers to grapple with the implications of humanist logic in their presentation of particular, often disturbing, representations of machine or biotechnological boundary creatures consigned to warehouses, toilets, rubbish heaps. So in today's presentation, I've used the analysis of literal disposable bodies as a catalyst to confront the concept of disposability itself and the humanist structures that produce and perpetuate it. These narratives and images of problematic disposal provoke us to care, or at least consider caring, about the fates of boundary creatures treated as inconvenient matter, as trash. And Catherine Hales' famous articulation, "We have always been posthuman," in that articulation, in other words, our bodies are, and lives are always already hybridized and entangled by technologies old and new. And I'm wondering, can we extend this awareness beyond our own post-human condition to more fully consider the more than human worlds that surround and entangle us? And moreover, might we convert this awareness into attention, into a form of care that resists human exceptionalism? These questions are the starting point for my work on post-human care, which counters disposable bodies with concepts of post-human care, a capacious vision of care that attempts to encapsulate the incredible range of affects, energies, behaviors, attachments, dependencies, both visible and invisible, that produce and sustain life in more than human worlds. Post-human care is a way of conceptualizing contact zones that makes room for Ibo, Pero, Pebbles, a significant relational creature without relying on individuality and humanity to justify and legitimize more than human post-human bonds.